right. Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7 and 103.9 on the air. And it is an absolutely bluebird perfect day here in the center of the universe. That would be Clear Creek County, Colorado, in the town of Idaho Springs. And we're in the Goat Shack here. And this is the Rabbit Hole. And we have a segment today we do periodically here. In fact, it's been, you know, much more frequent. And that is Writer's Talk. And in the studio with me is Sunny Weber. Did I say that correctly?
You
is
did.
It? Okay. You know, I never did ask you if it was Weber or Weber, but I assume Weber.
Weber, so. Yes.
All right. I like that. You know, so we have Sunny here on a sunny day, and it is gorgeous. And we're going to be talking about her work, Beyond Flight or Fight, and it deals with pets. And, you know, here in Clear Creek, we're all about pets, and particularly those that are challenged. You know that we have here in our community one of the few no-kill shelters in the country, and it is phenomenal the work they do there at Charlie's Place and so on. And so hopefully we have some pet lovers out there listening, pass on the message, and Sunny's going to give us some tips about working with those somewhat challenging little creatures. We love them, but they can be difficult, but it's a work there. Before we go on, I do want to thank Tommy Knockers for sponsoring that last hour. If you haven't tried out the Tommy Knockers, please get there. We want to thank all of our sponsors. Without them, community radio such as this, not possible. And shows like this, we could just sit down and talk to an author who has just done some brilliant work. Doesn't happen on corporate radio, but it does on community radio. And, you know, you might have gotten a message already, but we are in transition here at the Goat. Redevelopment on this side of town. So we have to simply relocate. And there's been a lot of discussion about where and how and when and all this other, but it's going to be coming a lot sooner than we thought. So, but we need some help, because it's not free. And so if you go to our website, there's a donation button, kygt.org, and just donate there. And of course, you could be listening to us, and maybe you are listening to us via streaming. But we need all the help we can, because it's only through our sponsors, and I am one, and I'm sponsoring this hour, by the way. And my book, Sisyphus Wins, got it out now, so you can go to my website and learn more about that if you haven't picked it up yet. And, you know, so my website is Jerry Fabianic. That's Jerry with a J and Fabianic, FABYANIC.com. And, yeah, love to have you take a look at that. And you got any questions, you can see me. But in the meantime here, we have Sunny Weber in the studio here. And Sunny has over 25 years of experience in pet rescue, humane education, shelter and sanctuary work, service and therapy dog training, temperament testing, behavior evaluation, obedience competition, fostering, pet medical care, horse ground training, and has authored articles and books in several fields. Wow, Bonnie, that's awesome. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I love it. You know, and as I say, here in Clear Creek, we have a special place in our hearts for our four-legged furry critters and so on. Tell us more. Okay, that's your background. You've obviously have done a lot, and you are doing a lot. What got you motivated? Where are you from and stuff like that? Just talk about yourself a little bit so we get to know you.
Well, actually, I'm a native. I grew up out near Morrison. When it used to be country, before it got all citified.
Before, in the land.
We had dogs time. And cats and horses and every kind of animal you can imagine. And it was a wonderful way to grow up, just taking off and riding a horse and having a dog at your side. And then I worked at ranches in the mountains before I, you know, settled down and got an education and went on. But it was wonderful just to sit on a horse, take a dog, and go wander. And I've always enjoyed training animals. And as I got more involved later in life, after I, you know, had to earn a living and get medical insurance and retirement, I got back into my passion, which is working with animals. And as I worked with them, particularly through my shelter work, I found that the most euthanized dogs are the fearful ones. There's various ways that dogs manifest fear, and some of them can be very, very difficult to work with. And all of a sudden, I found I had an affinity for those dogs. I knew what they felt deep down, gut level. And I thought, you know, they cannot verbalize, they cannot talk. And so I thought I can help them and find ways to help them fit into the human world so that they can get homes and then stay in those homes. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, though, people will go into a shelter or a rescue, and their heart will go out to the poor little guy cowering in the corner. But when they actually get the animal home into their lives, if they aren't experienced and are not familiar with all the picadillos that fearful animals can manifest, they feel overwhelmed, then they feel guilty, and they don't know how to work with the dog. They don't know how to make the dog feel comfortable. They don't know how dogs think. They don't know how dogs learn. And so consequently, when the negative emotions overcome the positive ones, and everyone wants a dog to attach to them, and sometimes these fearful dogs just don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. Children are like that. People that have social disorders that cannot attach. Animals are like that, too. And some of them come out of it, and some of them have a very difficult time. And some of them, you just have to accept them at the level they're at, because that's as far as they're going to go. But people have this image, and many people get dogs because they want to fill an empty spot in their life.
Right.
And if they get a dog that doesn't fill that spot, then where does it go? It ends up back at the shelter or the rescue. So I decided that I wanted to try to specialize in these animals. And I think through the years, as I worked with them more and more and more, and I have to admit, there were times when I was totally baffled. Some of the animals I was trying to rehabilitate, I had no idea what to do for that particular animal. And I would reach out to colleagues, and there was a real dearth of information. I mean, people just didn't know, because most of these animals never make it out of the shelter.
Right.
You know, they just, if they don't fit in the average patron's home, they get euthanized. And so I started experimenting with behavior and taking my business background and my psychology background and trying to put together techniques and experimenting. And I thought, okay, some things work, some things don't. You have to be ready. And dogs are so extremely forgiving. If you make a mistake, you can go back and start over. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that just about every dog I worked with, we placed, and they stayed in their homes.
Wow.
And it was so rewarding. And so I thought, I'm going to write a book about this, because as you get older, animal work is very, very physical. And it's like any other physical job. You're going to get to a point where that gets harder and harder for you to do. And also, what's in your head stays in your head. So you can teach and you can mentor. Plus, working one-on-one, one dog at a time, I'm not making a huge impact. I'm making an impact on that dog's world.
Right.
But there are many, many other dogs out there that need to be helped. So I thought, if I write a book, get what I know out there, people can read it, take what they need from it, and then we can together save far more dogs' lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing. And you're describing this, going in detailing it, Sunny, there were a number of thoughts that came up into my mind. I'm a retired teacher, for example, and I don't want to equate necessarily dogs with young people, but still, you mentioned like the fear that is within them. And one of my observations about humans is that what the most powerful motivator for people is fear. And you cover that actually in your title here when you say flight or fight. And that goes back to our, you know, Neanderthal days and before, because Neanderthal was a whole different man there. But so it's as if, and you mentioned also your psychology background. So in a way, very much in a way, you are getting into the head of the dog, you know, like the psychologist might do to sit down. You think of Sigmund Freud or Carl Jung. And, okay, what's motivated? What got you to this place then? Is that a work of art in terms of it could be learned? or is it something intuitive? Because you had said also in there about sometimes I'm not quite sure where to go and this one's not working and do all this. How does this play in? And, you know, and I'm probably covering a big range myself, but how do you approach this initially then with this idea that, okay, something's happening inside this dog's head and I need to get there and help him, her move to a better place?
That's an excellent question. And I've done a lot of thinking about that too, trying to figure out, you know, how has this always ended up being my field? It's like any other field. You need to learn the basic theory. You need to learn learning theory. You need to learn how to train dogs. You need to learn about motivation, positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, positive and negative punishment. You have to learn all the basics.
Okay.
And you have to learn the skills, and those are learnable. The instinct of understanding animals, I think it's a little bit of nurture and nature. I think nurture is what you learn. It's something you can pick up by being taught, being mentored, reading, doing however you gather your information, because everybody learns a little differently. But I think part of that is absorbed learning. And a part of that is instinctual. It's something you're born with. I think that Temple Grandin, Dr. Temple Grandin of Fort Collins, CSU, the famous animal behaviorist that's autistic, she's Asperger's. She endorsed my book. I was so honored that of all people, would endorse my book. I mean, she's had a movie made of her life. She's one of the top animal behaviorists in the world. She endorsed my book because she felt that it was time that people get information out about how to save shelter dogs. And she told me, we had a long conversation one time, and I had just sustained a severe head injury in a car accident. And we compared her Asperger's with my head injury, during which time I'd been diagnosed as ADD. I'd never been diagnosed before because in my generation, nobody thought about it. And she said, you and I, our brains are wired differently. And because of that, we get animals more than normal, quote unquote, people. And she was very encouraging to me during the really long recovery time I had from that head injury. When that occurred, I was in the process of training a service dog for a quadriplegic. And fortunately, that dog did not need a lot of real complex behaviors taught because after the accident, I couldn't do the problem solving. I was in the middle of writing a book. I couldn't even put sentences together. I couldn't punctuate. I had no word recall. And so I had to stop writing until I got healed. And I made a remarkable recovery. I was very, very lucky. But understanding the workings of my brain, I found it a challenge because I had a complete personality change. And everything scared me. I have never been like that. And everything was frightening, every new experience. I could be driving down the road, and like I say, I grew up here. All of a sudden, I'd have absolutely no idea where I was. And that is a scary, scary feeling. And the mood swings and the headaches and everything that comes from a head injury, plus the ADD became very pronounced after the head injury. And all the coping that I had learned to do just instinctually through the years went by the wayside, and I had to relearn how to cope with that as well. So the actual understanding of dogs that I come from an organic place, an injury place, having a brain that gets fear, that gets insecurity, that gets anxiety. I understand when a dog is having an anxiety attack, I know exactly what they're going through. The difference, though, is that having been a better coper, you know, a basically psychologically healthy person when my head injury occurred, I could logic my way out and say, this is part of the injury. Mm-hmm. I have to give this time, or I can take this medication that will help, or I can go take a nap and I'll feel better. I could logic my way through and project into the future of a better time. Animals can't do that. They live in the moment.
Right.
So when you leave a dog and it goes into a panic because they are not psychologically equipped, especially fearful dogs, to be alone, they have no way of knowing, well, mommy's going to be back in an hour. I'm just going to the grocery store. To them, it's the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they may indulge in destructive behaviors. They'll act out. They'll, you know, they live in the moment. They have no way to project into the future to a better time. And so a lot of what I do is, yes, the learning theory. And I worked for years to become a very good dog trainer. I had very good mentors, went to very good schools. Practice, which is what the obedience competition was all about, because I'm not a very competitive person. But I wanted to be the best dog trainer I could be. But the behavior end, the psychological end, that comes from the gut.
Mm-hmm. And you are able to identify in that, once again, I'm drawing off my experience, Sonny, as you're describing yours with the accident and then that stage you went through, in identifying that fear and then saying, wow, if I'm feeling this as a human being, imagine what this dog is feeling here that has been abandoned and so forth. And, you know, and I, again, draw to my analogy of being in the classroom, that there were certain individuals, my students that would come in, who would, you know, go to the corner, you know, put the head down and everything. And it's like, those are the ones I would try to really, you know, zero in on, more than the little ones up there going, pick me for the answer because I'm smart and I got it and everything. Of course, they have other needs as well. But to identify or to use your own human experiences, know what you went through. And so if I see, you know, one of the boys, you know, and he's kind of a loner walking by himself and everything, I go, I get that. Because when I was in third and fourth grade, I was that way too. And so why? What's happening there? Is there something happening at home? And it sounds as if you've done exactly that, or you're doing exactly that, because you have identified in your own human experience and now transferred it to the animal world, in this case here, dogs who are acting out fearfully and so forth. So I assume that's, you know, what we're talking about here.
Right, and exactly. And dogs, too, they come from a nature versus nurture standpoint, too. For example, some dogs learn to be afraid. They've been mistreated. They've been mm-hmm. abused. They've been neglected. Some dogs are just bred that way. A good case in point are puppy mill dogs. Mm-hmm. Puppy mill dogs live in a 3x4-foot cage, and there's usually 3 to 5 dogs in that cage. They are bred and bred and bred until they just can't have any more puppies. Mm-hmm. And there's usually one male and all these females. Their floor is wire. And then when you have a group like the famous National Mill Dog Rescue in Payton, Colorado, who are just phenomenal about going out and getting the used up puppy mill parents. Now, you can go to the pet store and buy a puppy and think, oh, how cute. But that dog came from a puppy mill. That's why we always say adopt, don't shop. You go to a pet store and you get this dog and you pay hundreds or thousands of dollars for this dog. The parents are still back there in those abysmal conditions. So National Mill Dog Rescue, who I do a lot of writing for, they go out once a month and they have relationships with several mill owners and they pick up the dogs they no longer want. So they are not killed. They are brought into a rescue environment. And that takes months and months of rehab because these dogs are genetically as well as behaviorally fearful, mm-hmm. unsocialized, anxious. A lot of these dogs have never drank out of a bowl. In those cages, they have those little rabbit bottles and they have mm-hmm. to lick mm-hmm. to get any water. So they live chronically dehydrated. Mm-hmm. They fight over food because one container of food is thrown into the cage and whoever gets it first. So a lot of them don't know how to eat or drink out of bowls. They've lived on wire floors. They don't have any idea what grass is, what any substrate is. You put them on carpet and they freeze. They don't understand linoleum. They can't do stairs. And they're so badly bred because they're bred only to pop out puppies to make money. So the puppies then can be very genetically, both physically and mentally, defective. And so a lot of the behavioral issues can come down to not just mistreatment, but also bad breeding. And so as a behaviorist and rehabilitator, I have to figure out what is motivating this behavior. Is it genetic? Or is it behavioral that they've learned? Is it learned behavior or is it genetic
because
behavior?
Because they're operating then the puppies within their own little society, and you're going to have the alpha perhaps who's going to dominate, and then you have the little scrawny one who's going like, oh, I want this little bite to eat, but we'll take on the alpha, and yet they're all, both are going to get adopted, and they are going to then model or project or carry with them the behaviors they learned in that cage, simply fighting for food or getting scraps and carrying that into the home.
And that's why the rehabilitation, despite some of the popular TV shows that are on about training dogs, nothing's quick. If you're going to truly turn a dog around, it takes a long, long time.
I wanted to ask you, what's the, I'm thinking of Horse Whisperer, but the guy who works with dogs.
Cesar Millan?
Yes.
Yes.
What about, you know, he seems like he walks in, he has this magical, boom, all of a sudden this dog is going, yeah, all of a sudden it's like, right? How credible is this?
Not.
Talk more.
Well, I do not like to bad talk anyone.
Sure.
But suffice it to say, you couldn't turn a kid around that quick. You can't turn anybody around. When you have psychological trauma, whether it's physical or learned, if it's bred in, if it's learned through bad experiences, it takes a long, long time to overcome that, if in fact you ever do completely overcome it. A lot of dog fear and anxiety can be managed. I don't know that it's ever totally cured. I have a Wheaton Terrier, for example, who is in my book. She came from a puppy mill. She was bought by a young couple who had her for a little over a year, and they brought her into the Dumfriends League shelter. And they said that, we have them. I volunteer at the Dumfriends League a lot for humane education and fostering and behavior. And they said that they wanted to have a baby, so they needed to give up the dog. Well, we're all looking at each other going, what? But we had a golden retriever, two-year-old, perfect dog that was dropped off. And the lady said, well, I changed the decor in my home and his fur no longer matches my couch. Okay, now we thought this was...
A lover owner?
Yes. And we thought this was like not true, but I have since heard that several times. So people can be extraordinarily fickle. And so when this Wheaton was dropped off at the shelter, they said, we want to have a baby, so we have to get rid of the dog. Well, she went catatonic in the shelter. This is before I met her. She curled up in a ball in the holding kennel in the back. Never made it to the adoption floor. She curled up in a ball. She pooped and peed all over herself. Wouldn't eat, wouldn't drink. Totally mentally shut down. Mm-hmm. Catatonic. And so they don't like to see dogs suffer. And so she was, marked for euthanasia. And one of the foster managers called me and said, could you please get her out of here and see what she's like in a home? So I said, sure. I went over, put a leash on her. She wouldn't move. I had to literally carry her out of the shelter. Now, on the questionnaire, the guy said she really likes to take car rides. So I got her out to my car where I'd left the door open. She saw that open car door, and thank God I had the leash already wrapped around my wrist because she shot out of my arms, got in the car, and was like in that car happy.
Oh, wow.
So nice. I got her home, and all the way home I'm watching her in the rearview mirror, and she's looking around, and she totally come out of her stupor. Mm-hmm. Now, with a catatonic dog, you don't always know if they're going to come out of that stupor. She did. And she was looking all around. I got her home. I walked around the yard on a leash, and she's pooping and peeing and sniffing, and just her little tail was wagging. And I began to work with her. Now, over the period of the next many months, I found this dog. I call her my little ADD dog because she is weird. She is just wired weird. She has all kinds of strange, bizarre fears and anxieties. And over the course of the next many months, I just determined she would not fit in the average person's home, and I ended up keeping her. It's 9 years later. We did eventually find out why they gave up the dog, and my belief is because they already had a child. And because she was not well socialized, she was a puppy mill dog that probably spent her crucial socialization time in a cage in a pet store. And then they didn't know how to work with her when they had their baby. And this toddler is probably screaming and hollering and crawling around and you know, poking her, and she could not take, she still can't take loud, sudden noises, fast movements. And so that wasn't going to be, I walked her past a playground, mm-hmm. just on a walk, because exercise helps anxious dogs. Mm-hmm. She went berserk. She got very fear aggressive towards the children on the playground. So then I knew, aha, this is what the issue was, really. They had a child, and she was probably aggressive towards the child, so they took her to the shelter.
Right.
Okay, and they didn't tell the shelter people.
Right.
So when intake at shelters and rescues, they don't always get the whole story, mm-hmm. as much as that would help in rehabilitating the animals they take in. So she came to live with me, and I figured this is no problem because I don't have kids. And my house is very quiet. It's arranged and redecorated. And I always have classical music going for all my fearful dogs. Anyway, my niece moved to town, who I adore, and she had some toddlers. And I went, uh-oh. Mm. They want to come to my house because Aunt Sunny has every Walt Disney movie known to man and all these animals. Mm-hmm. So they want to come stay at my house. So my niece and I began to work with her little kids with Bailey. And Bailey now is best friends with her little three-year-old toddler.
Okay.
And she takes food out of her hands. She lets her walk her on a leash. We did a lot of desensitization and habituation. The kids, as young as they were, got it.
Mm-hmm. You know,
kids love animals unless they're taught to fear.
Mm-hmm.
And they just took to our instruction beautifully, and the dog came around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a dog who's now had 9 extra years of life,
yeah.
of high quality life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my mission, is to help fearful dogs have high quality lives, be saved, be placed, and then stay in those homes.
And it seems to me then, backing up to the family that gave, her name's Bailey,
mm-hmm.
Up for adoption, had they known or taken or prepared to take the steps that you did, they might have been able to keep her. And
absolutely.
And so what do you suggest then to, you know, there's always situations like this. You get the dog home, it's not working.
Right.
So the first thing, okay, this isn't working. Boom, back to the shelter. Do
right.
that a couple, 3 times. Before you know it, the dog going like, okay, here we go again, sort
right.
of thing.
Right,
right. There's some just even basic ones. And I realize that each dog is, you know, has its own dogality, as I call it, personality. It's a dogality. And there's no one magical elixir. We talked about that earlier.
Right.
What are some things, though, that if you do, you know, you bring this pooch home, you know, cute as could be at the shelter, and then you come home and problems begin to arise.
Right.
What do you suggest?
Well, I've got a lot of steps in my book about how you handle that. And it can be go from very simple to very complex, depending on the dog, the age of the dog, the initial socialization period, the background experience of the dog, which sometimes you never know. You just have to put it together and figure it out from square one where you started. Any background experience you can get from people who've worked with that dog, whether it's a former owner, rescue personnel, foster parents, anyone who knows anything about the history of this dog is going to be very helpful for an adopter. And I tell all adoption counselors to make sure and provide that information for a potential adopter whenever you possibly can. And then there's always the importance, excuse me, of following up on the adoption. So most smaller rescues do that. But when you are working with a fearful dog, it takes a special personality. If you're a person who can't make a commitment and keep it, you don't want to adopt a fearful, anxious dog. They're going to take some work. And if you have a house of 5 kids screaming and hollering, you are not going to want a puppy mill dog.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair to the dog. It's not fair to your family. The matching is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a lot of speaking and writing about the importance of what an adoption counselor should know and to not just shove a dog out the door because someone wants it, because it'll be coming back. A good match is extraordinarily important. And so there are basic steps that you can take when you have chosen to take on a fearful dog. And I outline them all in my book, and various things work for different dogs. But most dogs will want a quiet home environment, particularly in the transition time, which is usually the first 3 months.
Okay.
Statistics have shown that 3 months a dog generally is settled in by then, even the most anxious ones. It doesn't mean that they're going to have all their fears satisfied and conquered, but the actual pack mentality where they feel part of the family can take up to 3 months. Mm-hmm. So you want to have a quiet, controlled environment. You want to have some decent ambient environment, like soft music. They've done tons of studies. A group in Fort Collins actually did a study on what music affects dogs, so that shelters now know, don't play rap or acid rock or Metallica in the shelter. Play classical music, soft, quiet music. It really does affect the heartbeat, the blood pressure of the animal, the psychological, you know, well-being of the animal, just like it does with people.
I was ready to say that. same thing.
Mm-hmm. It is exactly the same. Well, their brains are the same as ours. They have the same hormones, the same chemicals. They work the same way. The ambient environment is very important. Having a structured and very strictly structured daily routine, particularly in the transition period. So they learn to rely on a specific routine. And only after they're feeling comfortable and know what to expect in your home, then you can start small variances from that routine. Exercise, hugely important for an anxious, nervous dog. Now, in the case of, say, certain puppy mill dogs who've never been out of a cage, going for walks in the park is going to scare the crap out of them. Because it's a big world out there. So sometimes just a yard or one room in your house, but having that ability to play, to bond with you, whether it's indoors or outdoors, is very important. Exercise is very important, regardless of what form it takes to help that particular dog, especially in the initial stages. A lot of fearful dogs will find a safe place. They'll choose a place. It could be, for Bailey, it was one stair on my stairway and one corner of the couch. For another dog I had, it was under anything, end tables, chairs. They'll pick a safe place. Now, if they choose a safe place, it is your duty to make sure they are never frightened in that safe place, that no fear stimuli reaches them, that no frightful trigger can come near them. That safe place, they must learn that that safe place will always be safe. So then they can learn over a period of time to extrapolate that, okay, this little tiny corner of the couch is safe, the family room is safe. Then the first floor of the house is safe. Then the yard is safe. Then the park is safe.
Right.
And they learn that by trusting you.
Right. I was ready to, yeah. So it's the trust you're developing.
Absolutely.
Here. That relationship.
Trust is everything.
Okay.
Everything. You don't have, you cannot earn trust of a dog. You will not have a dog that does not fear.
Right. Yeah, I just want to. We're sitting here visiting with Sunny Weber and her work Beyond Flight or Fight, and particularly dogs. You know, I'm not sure if we're talking about cats in this here, but, you know, dogs, you know, that could be a whole other discussion, I suppose, comparing dogs to cats and the way they think and act and behave. And so you were describing that when you bring into the home a pet, and we, you know, you bring them home from the pet store. And just expect them to be perfect. And, of course, they're not, because they're products of puppy mills. We talked about that earlier. And they learned all kinds of different behaviors depending on their pecking order and, you know, this awful cage they grew up in. And they're bringing those behaviors home with you. You were talking, for example, having soft ambient music. Enya came to mind for me because she's my soft music person, you know. If I need that, I go to Pandora, put in Enya, there you go, I'm good. And there is something about that music sound therapy that works not only for humans, but you're pointing out, like the animal brain, the dog brain, very similar to the human. It's soothing, it's comfort. We don't want rap, okay, or that sort of, you know, upbeat, you know, a lot of troubadour, you know, like a brass and whatever it might be. Sunny, also diet, when you bring them in, is there certain foods that depend upon the situation again? Do you stay away from meaty foods, for example? Is it better to give them, you know, like grain foods? I don't know. What about diet, though, when you bring them in is it trial and error? Is there something it's better to start them with? You know, get them healthy and settled.
I haven't really found diet to be a huge part. You've got to give them a good balanced diet because a lot of dogs come from backgrounds where they didn't have that. Shelter dogs generally and rescue dogs generally are coming from groups that really care about them. And where, however they got them, who knows what they came from. But by the time they've landed in a shelter or a rescue or a sanctuary, they're with people who love them, who care for them, and who give them top-notch diets. Puppy mill dogs come in from horrible conditions, but when they're in a rescue, they are cared for greatly. So I don't find that diet is a huge, huge thing other than it should be discussed with your veterinarian. There are some foods out there that can be less energetic, and I think it has more to do with the age of the dog and the physical condition of the dog. So, for example, older dogs, which a lot of these puppy mill dogs are when they're done breeding, they can't eat a lot of heavy protein because their kidneys and liver just can't handle it. Younger dogs need the protein. They need to build their bones. And so the veterinarian is your best advisor on diet. And then, of course, just getting them used to whatever you can afford to feed them, because some of these diets can be quite expensive. But that's part of the responsibility of taking on a pet is, can you financially give this animal what it needs? Mm-hmm. And those are big decisions before you take on a pet. And we do talk about that in the book as well. If you can't afford to take on a pet and you can't afford to give them exactly what they need, for gosh sakes, go volunteer or foster, because all these organizations, these rescues, shelters, sanctuaries, they all need foster homes, especially fearful dogs, anxious dogs. They need to get them out of the commercial facilities. They do not thrive there. They are overwhelmed, like my little ADD dog, Bailey, shut down in a shelter because of the chaos and the noise. Other dogs do fine there. But fearful dogs and anxious dogs, timid dogs, they do not thrive. They need to get out into a home, and that is crucial to get into foster homes. And if you're a foster person, you can take on a dog and know you are saving that dog's life, because that dog needs to be in the quiet of a home. They need more attention. You can observe their behavior, learn what they need, so that when a potential adopter does come, you will be a huge stepping stone in teaching that adopter what that dog actually needs, which then will make sure there's a better match and that dog will stay in that adoptive home. Foster parents are just enormously important in the animal welfare world. They're a crucial, crucial stepping stone to helping socialize these animals. And the more you foster, the more experience you get. A lot of the rescues that specialize in these dogs, and a lot of the bigger shelters, like the Dunfermline League, actually has fearful dog programs. They can advise foster parents on how to deal. Their behavior departments can help you. There are individual behaviors that will work with people. And so when you get a dog in a home and you can't really afford it and you want to foster, then that rescue or shelter picks up the tab. And that's a good way to have a pet and still be contributing to the welfare of that animal and not have the bill. The other thing is to just go to the shelter or the rescue and volunteer. Walk the dogs, brush the dogs, socialize the dogs. There's a million and one things you can do to help save dogs if you can't actually have one. But again, fearful dogs take a special type of person. I found there's very different types of adopters depending on the dog personality. However, if you do end up in a position where you have adopted an animal and it isn't working out, then you owe it to that animal to take it back to the original foster or shelter or rescue, because they will then know, and then you fill out as much information as you can on that, so the next match is hopefully better.
And it sounds like a perhaps a strategy of prospective adopters out there to maybe spend some time at the shelters and working with them, so they get this, so they're not blindsided or, you know, like right. anticipating something very different. And they bring home this furry ball, and next thing you know, it's a whole different world for them. So they're not surprised or shocked.
Right. I get emails on my website, sunnyweber.com, all the time asking me, I brought home this dog and it's not working out. I'm having this issue. What do I do? And then I immediately either do a house call or answer them by phone or email. Usually I prefer personal contact so I can actually see the dog in the environment. But a lot of times when you see a bad match, I always ask the person, how did you come by this dog? And I can't tell you how many times people say, I liked her picture on the internet.
Yeah.
On the websites. Now, those pictures are there to help people pick a dog, and hopefully the shelter or rescue has very good photographers who present the animals in a very positive light. But I tell everybody, when you choose an animal by a picture on the internet, it's like an arranged marriage. You really don't know what you're getting into. And so I tell people, you need to visit with the animal many times. You need to see the animal different times a day. You need to take the animal for a walk on the grounds. A lot of places, for example, National Mill Dog Rescue, which I've mentioned a couple times, they'll allow you to take a dog home for an overnight. A lot of the smaller, more personable rescues will allow that. And I really highly recommend that you take the animal or foster and foster to adopt. That gives you a chance to try the animal out. And then if it doesn't work, you can keep the animal until it is adopted. So there are many different ways of doing that. But to just go in and pick an animal out of a lineup somewhere, you don't really know what you're getting into.
What about the notion? And I was very blessed when I had my chocolate lab, Knox, and had him for 10 years. And, you know, I always say that, you know, and he first... He belonged to a young friend of mine who adopted him, and he was in college, and it just one thing after another, he just couldn't take care of him, and it was either put him up for adoption or I took him in, and I'm going like, okay, I'm really not ready. But there was something when I look back on the history, I say, Knox adopted me. And what I would say is that it was hilarious in the sense that when the young man's name, it was Joe, and he's not such a young man anymore, and he would come to visit, and he'd bring Knox. And whenever Knox came, he would always sit by me and, you know, not by Joe. He loved Joe. You know, it was not a problem, but he would always come by me. And to the point, Joe would say, what am I, chopped liver sort of thing? And then it turned out that I ended up, you know, having him and caring for him. And eventually I was the one who made the call to put him to sleep. And I always say that Knox knew who was going to take care of him. I there's nobody could prove that. What's your sense on that, intuitive that, you know, people walk in and there's this one little pup, and then all of a sudden they come over to you, some other person there. Is there some validity to this or any type of study, or is that more like anecdotal, do you think?
Well, they say it's anecdotal, but I had a very similar thing happen. I went to visit a girlfriend who had just had a baby, and their dog had just had a litter of puppies, accidental backyard litter. And she said, do you want to see the puppies? And I said, no. Because then I'll want one.
You'll take them all home.
Yeah. And I said, I don't have the lifestyle for a puppy. I own a business. I live in a townhome. I don't have a yard, on and on and on. So long and short, we end up in the backyard, and this whole entire gaggle of puppies came in there clawing at my bare legs. It was a summer day. The parents are all like, pet me, pet me. And the puppies are all, and then back in the corner was this little guy just sitting there looking at me. Mm-hmm. I made eye contact with that dog and I knew I was done for. And I said, who's that? And she said, that's Spunky. And I said, why is he not coming forward? Is there something wrong? And she said, no, he just knows that when we come out here in the evenings to socialize the puppies, that he knows he'll get his. He's the runt of the litter, and he doesn't want to compete. And so he knows eventually someone will pay attention to him. And I just stepped over everybody and went to him and picked him up. And he just went nuts in my arms, licking me all over. And 7 days later, I went back and got him. And we were together 15 and a half years.
Wonderful. That's a great story. Yeah.
I don't know. Those are anecdotal stories. But I've seen it with kittens. Mm-hmm. I've seen it with horses. I've seen it with dogs. There's just, if you're a person that's open to that type of telekinetic communication, if you believe in that, I truly do believe that many animals will pick the person they want to be with. I was fostering a bunch of kittens. I do work with cats as well. And a lot of the stuff in my book, Beyond Flight or Fight, it's a compassionate guide of working with fearful dogs. But it began a book on cats and horses and dogs. And I narrowed it down to just dogs. Because when you have a large brain, social, highly social animal, like horses, cats, dogs, dolphins, elephants, the brain works the same as a person's brain. And the hormones are the same and the emotions are the same. And so the techniques in this book will work for other animals. But I had a whole litter of orphan kittens. And some people were coming to my house to look to see if they wanted to adopt these kittens. And I've completely remodeled my house for animal care. My upstairs, I've taken all the carpeting out of the bedrooms and their cat rooms. And the downstairs, I've completely remodeled for dog care. So there's no carpeting. It's all, you know, laminate flooring. So in case somebody has an accident, it's cool.
Easy.
Yeah. Dog door, big yard. And so I was fostering these kittens until they were old enough to go up for adoption. And people were coming from the shelter to look at them. And one of my friends walked in, and he's a veterinarian down in Franktown, and he's had a lot of animals, and he owns the Franktown Animal Clinic, Dr. Dave, and he walked in the room, and this little kitten that I had nursed, I had eyedropper fed from 10 days old, up to bottle feeding, I saw this cat first. She was a climber before she was a walker. I called her Monkey. She went over to Dave. Because by then she was walking, toddling around. She walked right up his jean pant leg. She climbed all the way to his waist.
Mm-hmm.
Only one that did it. And I said, Dave, I think you got yourself a cat.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, he adopted Monkey.
Wow.
So you just don't know. I believe there is a lot of that social connection. But on the other hand, I've had animals that I had no connection with that simply needed me.
Right.
Really highly unsocial animals, senior animals that were in the midst of the ends of their lives, that had no place to go, that had dementia, that were not bonded. And that was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I accepted them for what they were and gave them the last good year of their life.
Nice.
That's part of rescue.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to fall madly in love with every single animal you take in.
Mm-hmm. Be humane.
Be humane, give them the best you can give, because anything you give them is going to be better than being homeless.
Right. And what about breeds? Now, I had a chocolate lab, and labs tend to be friendly, engaging. They love everybody. They'll look, I tell the story, I was walking through Georgetown and had them on a leash. We're walking down bright summer day, just like today. And there was this young family there and a little girl, a couple, 3 years old, sitting in their chair. She had an ice cream cone. And so Knox went over and started sniffing. Well, see the puppy. And she started petting. Next thing you know, the ice cream was gone. Knox is just like, bam, got it. You know. And of course, I'm shocked. You know. And the parents were laughing. And the little girl, she went, Mommy, look, the doggy ate my. You know. And they were totally cool with the whole thing there, too. You know. So I'm used to that. And then there's the pit bull and the Rottweilers, who have a very negative image and reputation. Talk about that, Sonny. You were talking earlier about dogs that were bred certain ways.
Right.
Dogs like that, those species, others, what about them?
You know, most people who are in the animal welfare world that specialize in dogs don't believe in breed-specific legislation. They believe in vicious dog legislation. So we don't believe that there should be laws against specific breeds because there's going to be an exception to every rule.
Mm-hmm.
I know some adorable pit bulls that wouldn't, in a million years, would not even think of even growling at a human.
Mm-hmm.
My niece herself has this gigantic Rottweiler named Remington.
Mm.
And Remington thinks he's a lap dog. The dog weighs 150 pounds. And I have had this dog around. He actually has a little brother Yorkie puppy. And he plays with hamsters, and he lives with three little kids. And this dog is the biggest baby.
Teddy bear.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, huge.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, huge. And, I mean, this dog would not lift a lip towards anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is breeding. A lot of it is socialization. A lot of it is kind, humane treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually take, as a matter of fact, a good example of this, Michael Vick's fighting dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Bronco Michael Vick, who was convicted of having a dog fighting kennel.
Right.
Horrible, horrible, quote, sport, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, his dogs were all confiscated. And he went to jail. All of his pit bulls were in such horrid, horrid condition, both physically and mentally. The only way to save them was they were court-ordered to go to Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah. I have been there and volunteered there many times. Fabulous, fabulous opportunity if you want to go work with animals. They take in dogs, cats, horses, rabbits, goats, wildlife, everything. And it's in stunning Red Rock Country in Kanab, Utah. One of the founders, Faith Maloney, who was the original dog care person for the rescue and now sanctuary, endorsed my book as well because we've known each other for years. And they took in the Michael Vick dogs, and all but a handful, like three of them, are in homes now with people. They rehabilitated them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference between a sanctuary and a rescue is that the sanctuary will keep animals for their entire life. There were like three dogs that were not going to work out in a family environment, but they are working out with the handlers there at Best Friends, and they have a home for life at Best Friends Animal Sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of dogs can be turned around, a lot.
I would imagine then it would also take the personality of the adopter.
Yes.
That would tie into that and, you know, in that regard there. So,
right.
Yeah, speak
exactly
to that a little bit.
The personality of the adopter is crucial to saving these dogs' lives, and that's why adoption counselors have to be very, very good at screening, because adopters can be like the woman who had the golden retriever who gave it up because the fur didn't match her couch anymore. It could be like the people who owned my Wheaton Terrier who gave her up because she was child aggressive and they did not know how to or want to work with that. Adopters are crucial, and so screening adopters as an adoption counselor is a skill that you need to work on and develop, because that adopter can save that dog's life. And you may have to have someone who's got more skill than another. You may have to wait longer to have that dog placed because you're waiting for a particular type of adopter. A friend of mine and I started Colorado Australian Shepherd Rescue years ago. We were the only Aussie rescue in the area. And we screened horribly closely. And if I felt that there was a person and a dog, they may have fallen in love with the dog for its color or its activity level or whatever. But if I felt it was not a good match, I was very honest with the patron. And I said, you are not going to want this dog. And this is why we have another dog here. Or if we don't, we will find you one. Because that's part of getting to know people. People often think, I want to work with animals because I don't really like people.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't. You have right. to work with people and animals. And you have to know people like you do animals. And that's why I feel I am good at what I do, because I understand people, and I've worked in service companies all my life, but also I get the animals, and it's kind of a combination of knowing the behavior of both to make that good solid match.
Yeah, and it sounds as if those types of people who are animal abusers would also be people abusers.
Absolutely. It's a proven fact that every mass murder in history started on animals, usually small, helpless animals, cats, rabbits, birds, and then moved on to dogs and gradually went up the evolutionary scale to where they ended up killing people. And that, without a doubt, that's why when the shelter in Iowa that was broken into and started on fire by some thugs, some teenage thugs there, and the judge at the time sort of laughed it off and said, well, they were drunk and they're teenagers. Okay, you can't take it like that. These people are going to escalate. Aggression escalates, whether it's in a dog or a human. It will escalate unless you extremely important steps are taken to cure it, to control it, to manage it. And now it is a proven fact that more and more law enforcement organizations are being trained by animal behaviorists mm-hmm. to understand the behavior of these people who do victimize animals.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. And Sonny, we only have a couple of minutes left, but you know, I'm looking at the concepts you and I talked about before we went on the air. We wanted to cover, you know, in like your various chapters and everything about having them feel a place of safety, bringing them into the home, socializing them with other animals and people. And it sounds as if your work does that step by step.
Right.
And you want to talk about that just for a few moments, because we want people to go to your website, talk about that, and how to get a copy of your work here.
Okay, my book is available on my website, also on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. It's in ebook as well as paperback. It's called Beyond Flight or Fight. I switched Darwin's saying of fight or flight because dogs would rather run away from a conflict than fight. But It's Beyond Flight or Fight, a compassionate guide for working with fearful dogs. And it is a dog book that will work with all dogs. It'll even work with kids. I've had some child counselors who have commented on my Amazon reviews that it helped working with kids. But it is a book about working with fearful dogs. It's readable. It's for the layperson. My audience, my desired audiences, are new animal welfare people who haven't got the experience to work with these fearful dogs that are exposed to them every day and are crucial to saving their lives. It's for foster people who work with these animals, who get in them in their home and don't really know then what to do with them and how to help them get adopted. And for adopters who take on these dogs with all the best meaning in the world and all the best intentions in the world. And then things come up. And you don't want to feel like you've got a bad match or that you don't have a good relationship. This book is all about building a solid, understanding, mutually rewarding relationship between the fearful dog and the person who loves it.
Nice. All right. Thank you so much. And by the way, I do want to conclude. You had mentioned Temple earlier.
Yes.
And her endorsement right on the back. And it says, Beyond Flight or Fight will help you rehabilitate high fear dogs that may have been neglected or abused. Lots of step-by-step practical advice.
Right.
And that's exactly what you've been detailing here, Sonny.
Right.
That's
awesome. I want to reach the average person who wants to help save dog lives. And my website is www.sunny, S-U-N-N-Y, Weber, W-E-B-E-R.com. I hope I hear from you.
Right on. And you can contact you through
Absolutely.
That. Emails are on there,
right.
too. Oh, this has been rewarding, so fascinating, and I've had a variety of authors on, and I am just like this one. Yeah, we're talking dogs. We're talking. Oh my God, my heart just breaks on some of this stuff here. And on the cover, is that a pit bull?
No, that's a mixed breed.
Okay,
my favorite kind of dog.
Okay, yeah, because it's got the short ears and so
yeah,
forth
that is a typical fearful dog stance.
Yeah, oh.
And I have pictures throughout the book at the beginning of every chapter that illustrate the way fearful dogs look, mm-hmm. So that you can read their body posture and understand what fear really looks like in a dog.
Oh, you got a little sad guy there.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay, folks, you got to get this book. I'm serious. I haven't read it yet. I bet I'll be launching into this a little bit later there. Look at that with the teeth bare.
Yeah, that's fear aggression.
Fear aggression. Oh, yeah. I know some people look just like that. But not as cute. Definitely not as cute. All right. Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabiana, KYGT LP FM 102.7, 103.9. Thanks for joining. This has been The Rabbit Hole. Neighborhood Earth is next week with Randy. The Rabbit Hole and Authors or Writers Talk here with Sunny Weber and her book, once again, Beyond Flight or Fight. Please pick it up. Go to her website, sunnyweber.com, Amazon. Get it. We're dog lovers up here in Clear Creek, everywhere. And do your part. I will be back in a couple of weeks, and I think I have one or two more authors I'm going to talk to also there, and not coming to mind right now. But anyway, it's fun, and be safe. We'll talk soon, and I'm going to call it an early day for me today. It's been a long day, but, you know, I was out at the parade this morning and everything too, so I'm going to go ahead and move on today, but I got some music for you in the background here, and I'll be back in two. So thanks once again. Bye now.